morning. Delighted to welcome you to our first and only day of oral argument in December. We will have the Menominee Falls High School students. They are not here yet, but are driving towards Madison, and they may come. So if you hear people enter, it's our high school students. They will be here as a result of a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And that in that program, we invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if and when they come, they will listen to the oral argument. They've been given materials about this case. They may have engaged in activities relating to this case. And after the second case is heard, they and other students who will be here at 10:45 and maybe students who will be here at 1:30 will meet with a justice to discuss the procedural aspects of the case, not the substantive issues we are going to discuss. And counsel, as well as everyone else, you're all invited to attend that session at noon. In that session today will be presented by Justice Prosser. So we shall proceed with our case today, and I hope that when they enter, it won't create too much disturbance for counsel. The first case is 10-AP-321, Brown County Department of Human Services versus Brenda B. Arguing on behalf of Brenda B. is Leonard D. Kaczynski. Arguing on behalf of Brown County is Robert J. Collins II. Mr. Collins will get 30 minutes. Mr. Kaczynski will get 25 and then have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay? Mr. Kaczynski.
May it please the court, I'm attorney Len Kaczynski and I represent Brenda B. in this case. This case involves exactly what a trial court needs to advise any parent who's considering a no contest admission to grounds for termination of parental rights before that colloquy can be a valid one. In this case, there's a number of precedents that this court has set regarding what those requirements are before a parent can validly waive the initial phase of a termination of parental rights case. The first one that this court did some time ago was Stephen H., which we cited in our reply brief. And what the Stephen H. case said that it was that a parent could not waive the fact-finding hearing for the first phase or the grounds phase of a termination of parental rights case unless they're fully advised of their constitutional rights and waive them. This court also addressed that issue in Jody W., and that involves not only basic concepts of due process, but also the requirements of Section 48.427 of the statutes, which sets forth what's necessary in order to have a valid admission for grounds of termination of parental rights. Now, a couple of years ago, the Court of Appeals made the decision Yasmin B., also known as Teresa S., and that case, that issue was raised as to what the requirements were for a valid admission or no contest admission to grounds for termination of parental rights. And the Yasmin B. court said that you needed to have a waiver of or an understanding of your giving up, a filing of fitness, and also to know what the options were at disposition. That is, that disposition at a termination of parental rights case could be either termination of parental rights or dismissal.
Mr. Kaczynski, as I understand your argument, You are alleging on behalf of your client that the trial court, prior to accepting the admission that grounds exist for termination, should have advised her, should have advised your client that she was giving up her constitutional right to parent her child. Does that sum up part of your argument?
That's part of it, Your Honor, yes.
But that raises the question for me of, I'm not sure that's true at the admissions phase, because the admissions phase was waived by her admission, and then it proceeds to the dispositional phase where the trial court could have said, focusing on the best interests of the child, no, termination of parental rights is not necessary here, so therefore I will dismiss the petition. Now, there are no number of other options, but termination is but one of them. So I'm not sure that that's that would have been accurate for the trial court judge to have said.
I think the issue is that when you get to the dispositional phase of a termination of parental rights case, the court does not give any deference whatsoever to any rights that a parent might have.
Once because the focus is on, at the dispositional phase, the focus is on the best interests of the child.
Correct.
Okay.
And so in that case, the deference that is granted, we grant to parents under the Constitution is gone. The only thing that the court then considers at that point is the best interest of the child. There's no deference given to any constitutional right to parents. So,
but I don't see that response changes or that observation changes the fact that by the admission, the parent who is admitting to the grounds is not by necessity agreeing to the termination of parental rights.
Oh, absolutely. And often a parent might decide to enter a no-contest admission or an admission to grounds for termination of parental rights because the evidence is overwhelming and things might come out in the trial that would make things even worse.
The second part of my question is, on that same issue, if the trial court had said, prior to accepting the admission that grounds exist for the termination of parental rights, had said, do you understand that you are giving up your constitutional right to parent your child, wouldn't that have indicated some kind of prejudgment on the part of the trial court judge, kind of signaling what Judge Hinkfuss was going to do at the dispositional phase?
It would not necessarily do that because the legal tests are different. You have to use the best interests in the dispositional phase. So if you said you're giving up your constitutional right to parent, the court also is going to say I could make a decision based on other factors that we're not going to terminate your parental rights in this case, and then you go to the three different options.
But I guess my concern is, wouldn't your proposed part of the colloquy on the judge's part signal that the determination has been made that I am going to terminate your parental rights, and the dispositional hearing is but a mere formality?
I don't believe it would. I mean, I can understand why somebody might think that when they listen to those words, but the other part of the equation is that there's the different options at disposition, including possible dismissal. So because there'd be that additional explanation and the additional hearing at the second phase, the parent would not necessarily feel or shouldn't necessarily feel that their loss of parental rights is predetermined.
What authority do you have for saying that at the end of the first stage, the constitutional right to parent is now given up? I mean, that's your position, right?
Correct.
I want to know where you find that in case law, in the United States Supreme Court, or here, or in the statute, because I'm going to ask the same question of the Brown County Department of Human Services, whether they agree with you.
I think it comes just from an analysis of the different legal standards that are imposed upon a judge's determinations or a fact finder's determination at the first and second phase.
The interest of the parent doesn't come in the second phase. I mean, it's the interest of the child.
Correct.
That's your position.
Correct. Prior to the first phase, we give all kinds of deference to parents, even if we think they're making the wrong decision. So that's really the issue at that point.
And so then the disposition might be, even though the parent is not fit, it's still, under all the circumstances, better than some other disposition in the best interest of the child.
Correct, Your Honor. There may be situations, and they usually aren't brought because of that. For example, the court may feel there's no adoptive parent available, and this parent is paying child support as a job, and we can still financially support the child. So even though we don't think he's much of a parent, we're not going to terminate parental rights because we would like this parent to financially support the child.
And just would put placement elsewhere, maybe, under those circumstances.
Correct.
But not terminate parental rights.
Correct.
So you're basing the constitutional right to parent on a concept of what the standard of the exercise of discretion is. You're basing it on the best interest of the child. Therefore, by definition, you wouldn't have a parental right, a constitutional parental right.
Correct.
So, counsel, exactly what would you have had the trial court say at this hearing? What are the words that would satisfy you, and what do you want a trial court judge from this point forward to say so that someone, so we don't end up with the same appeal?
I think the court would need to advise the parent, do you understand that you're giving up your constitutional right to parent and that that right's no longer going to necessarily influence
You are giving it up?
The parent is, yes. The right, your constitutional right to parent is not going to be an influencing factor on my decision in the second phase of the proceeding. And second of all, the second phase of the proceeding, I could either terminate your parental rights, I could dismiss the petition, or I could place the child in sustaining care. I don't think you needed to go into all the many different myriad options in 48.428 that Judge Hoover seemed to think would be required as part of a valid colloquy.
So you think a person knows what sustaining care means?
They may not. Hopefully they have counsel that tells them, but it's something different, clearly, than termination or dismissal. That is, the child is going to be kept in some sort of situation till he or she turns 18.
Would a form satisfy that if they passed down a form that basically outlined what the statute said?
I think a form would certainly be helpful, just like plea questionnaires in criminal cases have been enormously helpful in holding up pleas against attempts to withdraw them after they're done. There are
At this hearing, you don't think that she understood that this involved her parental rights being terminated. That is, giving up your right to parent. You don't think that she knew that's what was going on here?
We don't. The record doesn't reflect that she does. There, of course, if the court grants our appeal, it will back to Judge Hinkvist for an evidentiary hearing, and I expect the county would call Attorney Freilich on behalf of the county as to what those explanations were. Brenda would testify, and the court would make a decision based upon the evidence whether or not she really did understand it.
I guess that's part of what I'm struggling with here. I mean, the kind of case this is a termination of parental rights case. It's labeled a termination of parental rights case. The phrase termination of parental rights is used repeatedly in documentation and by the court. The judge says, if I accept your plea, I have to make a finding of parental unfitness. Do you understand that? And then he then says at the second hearing, it's dispositional, although a jury may decide that there are facts to terminate parental rights of a parent. That is you, Mrs. B. It does not have to be done. You know, and then he goes on, he talks about different alternatives. But you think she missed that this was termination of parental rights case? I just have to figure that out in my own mind because it's all over the place.
Well, she missed that she's basically losing her constitutional right to parent, that she even has a constitutional right to parent that's just as vital as the right to free speech, freedom of religion, bearing firearms, and other explicit guarantees in the Constitution. It's just not raised to that level on that particular issue of constitutional rights.
Okay, thank you.
Well, my recollection, counsel, of the transcript is that the trial court judge did indeed advise your client that her admission to the grounds, to the fact that the grounds exist for the termination of parental rights, could in fact lead to the, her parental rights being terminated.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Judge Hinkvist, I think, very clear, followed Yasmin B. to the letter and maybe even then some, but didn't go on to the second areas of Yasmin B. where Yasmin B.'s counsel.
Would it have satisfied your concern if Judge Hinkvist, instead of simply stating to your client that her admission to the grounds for, existing for the termination of parental rights could lead to the termination of parental rights, would it have satisfied your concern if he had advised your client that her admission to the grounds could lead to the termination of her constitutional right to parent her child?
Yes, as to that particular portion of the issue, that would have made a difference.
Did the judge or anyone have to say to her, you are going to lose your constitutional right? I mean, as you indicated in questioning from another member of the court, a layperson and probably many a lawyer would not know what is meant by you're going to lose your constitutional right to parenting. Wouldn't it be okay if you said exactly what Justice Gableman said, that if you acquiesce to this allegation, you could lose your parental rights at the disposition hearing? You're setting yourself up for that.
I think the additional word of constitutional has a lot of meaning, or should have a lot of meaning to someone. It's not just something that's set forth by the state in a statute, but also something that's of a greater dimension.
The point of this colloquy is to not whether the counsel understands all this, but whether or not the mother, you're the mother, right?
Correct.
Understands it. So you have to, the whole point of the colloquy is to put this into layman's terms and yet be correct legally, right?
Correct.
And get responses, or colloquy means some sort of dialogue going with the mother to ensure to the judge and then to an appellate court that there is a basic understanding, right?
Right.
Now, the judge didn't ask this, but Attorney Collins did. Attorney Collins asked Brenda B., quote, "And my last question, do you understand that by giving up your right to fight that allegation," and I'm assuming that's the allegation that she's unfit, "do you understand that by giving up your right to fight that allegation, you could lose your parental rights to DF at the dispositional hearing?" And she responded, "Yes." Now, I think what you want, you should correct this, is you could lose your parental rights to DF at the dispositional hearing because the court will look only at the best interests of the child, comma, not considering your parental rights per se, in and of themselves. Isn't that what you want?
That would be a better expression of it than I just previously gave, Your Honor, yes.
Something like that,
and I think
anyway.
That's something that's a person of ordinary or even less than ordinary intelligence, which comprises a lot of the parents in TPR cases, would probably be able to understand.
But even that hypothetical question by Chief Justice Abrahamson includes the word could lose your rights.
That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so that's different from where you started out. At least when I asked you about your argument, about your position, I thought I understood you to say at the beginning of this hearing that you expected the trial court, and from my reading of your briefs, you expected the trial court to have advised Brenda B. that her admission is a waiver of her constitutional right to parent her child. So which is it?
Well, it is a waiver because, as the proposed phraseology indicates, that there's a whole different legal standard that applies in the second phase.
So your response to Chief Justice Abramson's question included, you just told her and told us that it would be enough if the judge said your admission could lead to the termination of your parental rights. I'm just having a little bit of difficulty following your argument.
It's not just a question of terminating your parental rights, but losing your constitutional right to parent, which is slightly different. I think that's the difference in the.
Please explain that difference.
Sure. If you enter an admission to a grounds for termination of parental rights, but you're including within that is not only a waiver of procedural rights to due process, a hearing, and so forth, but also to your constitutional right to parent a child, which has been determined to exist, I believe, under the 10th Amendment.
Let me try it this way.
Okay.
Would satisfy you? The trial court, which are you expecting us to, if you could write this opinion, Mr. Kaczynski, if you had the opportunity to sit down and write the majority opinion in this case, would your rule be that the trial court in this instance has to say, and this is kind of a follow-up of Justice Eagler's question as well, would the trial court judge have to say to someone in your client's position, your admission that grounds exist for the termination of your parental rights is a constitutional waiver of your parental rights? Or, in regard to what you just answered the Chief Justice, would it be satisfactory to you if the trial court had said your admission could lead to the termination of your parental rights?
I think the word constitutional waiver is the appropriate phraseology, plus in addition, of course, the fact that there could be a loss of parental rights because you're going to the second phase of the hearing. You really need both in there, both the constitutional waiver of the substantive constitutional right to parent as well as more procedural potential loss of parental rights at the second phase of termination of parental rights hearing.
Could I ask a question? A parent has some procedural rights at this ground stage, is that right?
Correct.
And some of those are alluded to in the statute?
Correct.
Are any of them constitutionally based?
The procedural rights, I suppose, have never been challenged, I think, under due process they exist, but they also exist statutorily.
But, I mean, is there a due process basis for some of those procedural rights?
Because of the substantive right involved, I would say yes. The state couldn't take away somebody's parental rights without having a fair hearing.
Okay. Well, and does the parent have to give up those procedural rights on the record?
If there's going to be a valid waiver of the first phase of a parental rights termination proceeding, they have to give up the procedural rights. It's our position also they need to affirmatively on the record state they're giving up also the substantive constitutional right to parent.
Let me just interject. If a parent doesn't show up, they don't have to do that. They can be defaulted, right?
Correct.
Okay.
My question is, when in the plea colloquy, when the parent is asked to give up certain procedural protections, is it a defect if the word constitutional is not included in the question about the procedural rights?
Not about the procedural rights, no.
But I thought you said that some of those procedural rights were constitutionally based.
The way it's so typically stated in terms of jury trial, calling witnesses, and things like that, it's something that's more understood. The substantive right is not as easily understood by the typical parent as those procedural rights that apply to all kinds of legal proceedings.
So are you saying that the parent would understand each of the procedural rights – without any reference to their constitutional basis, but would not understand that they were giving up the right to their child unless the word constitutional were used?
I don't think they'd understand the profound nature of that and how the whole system of protections and burden of proof changes from the first phase to the second phase unless the words constitutional right to parent or something similar to that was stated in a plea colloquy.
So the word constitutional has to be there or it's a defective plea colloquy.
As to the substantive parental right, yes.
What is the constitutional right? I have to keep coming back to that. What is the constitutional right of parenting that is being given up on the no contest? Isn't it that the only interest then becomes the best interest of the child? Isn't that the substantive right being given up?
Correct. Prior to that being given up, the parent has the other rights to education and
right.
So forth.
And the procedural rights that are given up, you have no objection. She gave them up because they have procedural rights in the first phase.
Correct.
Isn't that right?
Correct.
Your fight is, if I understand it, that it's she was not told in the first phase that as a result of a no contest, then in the second phase, only interest that the court will consider is the best interest of the child, not her interest as a parent.
Correct.
Right, and the reason for that, the reason for the shift in the focus at the dispositional phase is because of a finding of parental unfitness. True?
Correct.
And so I guess this whole conversation raises an interesting point, which is what is the constitutional right of an unfit parent to parent a child?
That.
None if you're unfit, perhaps.
Question mark.
Since that's part and parcel of grounds for termination of parental rights.
Is it? The determination as to whether the unfit parent understands the distinction, admittedly on your behalf, which I appreciate, the very fine distinction between the waiver of a quote-unquote right versus a quote-unquote constitutional right being expressly stated, that comes towards the end, as it would have in this colloquy, of the discussion to determine whether grounds exist that the parent is unfit or an admission of the same. It just simply raises an interesting point. The red light is on. It's a fire alarm day.
just 1 second. Justice Bradley, you had a question. Do you want to pose it? And you didn't get an opportunity.
I'll pursue it with other counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Justices, my name is Attorney Robert Collins. I am a staff attorney with Brown County Corporation Counsel. In this matter, I represent the petitioner respondent, the Brown County Department of Human Services. This case involves a six-year-old child named DF, who has been out of home care for the last 28 months. The mother, Brenda B., alleges that the circuit court violated two mandatory duties at the plea colloquy when taking the parent's no-contest plea. Brenda B. raises two issues. The first issue is whether the circuit court must inform the parent that they will lose their constitutional right to parent that child prior to a finding of unfitness, even though parental rights may not be terminated until the completion of a dispositional hearing. The second issue is whether the circuit court has satisfied Wisconsin Statute Section 48.422, sub 7, sub A, when the parent is informed that, after being found unfit as a result of the no contest plea, the mother will transition to a dispositional hearing where the court will either dismiss or grant the petition after considering the best interests of the child. In regard to the issue regarding the constitutional right to parent the child, I will concede that the circuit court did not say the magical words constitutional. What the circuit court did in this case is explain to the parent that she would be found unfit and that after that, the proceedings would move on to a dispositional hearing where the court could either terminate her parental rights or dismiss the petition.
Is it your position that there is no need for the judge at the first stage of the proceedings, the unfitness stage, to advise the parent that either they are or could be giving up their right to parent as a result of the no contest plea?
I don't think it's necessary to tell them that they are going to. As Justice Gableman said, that's a decision that's going to be up to the court come disposition. The court's going to have the discretion to allow that parent to maintain those rights. As Justice Ziegler had asked Attorney Kaczynski, if I can make a test in this case, I think what the circuit court needs to do is inform the parent that the plea is going to lead first to a finding of unfitness. After that finding unfitness, the proceedings are going to move to a dispositional hearing where the court really has two options, either to terminate the parental rights of the parents or to dismiss the petition.
So your answer to my question is no?
Correct.
Okay. That leaves for me, we've got a lot of these statutes and it's kind of a puzzle putting them all together, and that leaves for me a hole, not W-H-O-L-E, but H-O-L-E, in the scheme. Let me explain and see if you agree or disagree. When Justice Ziegler was talking about not the necessarily the adequacy of what was said at the colloquy, but, you know, come on, didn't the mother really know? Termination of parental rights. This case is about termination of parental rights. I call the case of the termination of parental rights. Anyone would know this case is about termination of parental rights, or so the argument or the reasoning would go. But, and that's compelling. And yet, this case, the most important thing is a parent going to give up the kid? And yet that seems to be the only right that doesn't have to be told that they have. They have to be told you have the right to have a trial by jury, a right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, a right to call witnesses to testify on your behalf. You have the right to make the county prove its case by evidence that is clear, satisfactory, and convincing. Do you understand you're going to be giving up all of those rights? They have to be told those things. But the thing that this case is all about, they don't have to be told. That's the whole.
Well, do you think
it's... Can you patch that hole for me?
I can patch that hole. In this case, what the circuit court told the mother was at the dispositional hearing, there was the potential for her to lose her parental rights. And I think that that's true.
Is that a requirement in a colloquy? Do they have to be, you know, you've got the Stephen H. case, you've got the Jody case, and your argument, as I understand your arguments of the brief, is that they don't have to be told about this right, whether it's a constitutional, you use the phrase constitutional or not, they don't have to be told about it because at that stage of the proceeding, they are not giving up that right. So they don't have to be told about it. Of course, it doesn't make any sense that at the next stage of the proceeding, they'd be told about it because it doesn't come into play because it's in the best interest of the kid. So do they ever have to be told about it?
They have to be told about it. I don't think that they have to be told about it in terms of you're going to lose your constitutional right to parent, but under Wisconsin Statute Section 48.422, sub 7, sub A, the parent needs to know the potential disposition.
That's the second question, and whether or not this colloquy was adequate with regard to guardianship and sustaining care. But with regard to you have, just like you have a right to confront and cross-examine witnesses and to call witnesses to testify on your own behalf, just like, although that's a procedure right, do they have a right to be told that by entering a plea of no contest, they are giving up their right to parent?
I don't think they have a right to be told that. I think it would be sufficient if the court told them that there's the potential that they will lose that right.
So they don't have to be told about that right that they are giving up. Yet, of course,
That's what this is all about. I mean, the parent isn't coming and saying, boy, I'm going to fight for my right to confront and cross-examine witnesses these next 2 days. That's not what the parent is there for. They are there for fighting for their right to parent their child. And yet you're saying that's not required. It seems to me it should be required because that's what this is all about. And it should be required at a time when it's meaningful. I understand your argument to be it's not required.
It's not. But in this case, I would point out in the transcript where I had questioned Brenda B. and I had informed her regarding the rights that she would lose if her parental rights were terminated. And I went over the loss of the right to have visitation with the child, the loss of the right to know information about the child, including where the child is going to school, and information about the child's health, the loss of the right to make any decisions for the child, that the child would no longer have the right to inherit from the mother, and the mother would no longer have the right to inherit from the child, and finally the loss of the right to custody of the child. I then went in to explain to the mother and question her whether she understood that by entering a no contest plea at the ground stage, she would be unfit and could potentially lose her parental rights. I think the substance of what I tried to communicate to her were in terms that she could understand and really conveyed to her the quote-unquote constitutional right that the mother is now alleging that she wasn't informed of.
And that sounds, I commend you. You know, I think that's a good record. The question I have is, it seems to me your argument is that it was good, but it was gratuitous. It wasn't necessary to be advised that by entering a no-contest plea, she's giving up her right to parent.
I don't see anything in the statutes or case law that mandate it. Do I think it's good practice? Personally, yes.
Counsel, this portion of the colloquy from the bench seems to be revealing to me another hole, H-O-L-E, as Justice Bradley says. And that is the presumption we all seem to have that it would be accurate to tell someone in Brenda B's position that by admitting to the existence of grounds for unfitness and therefore a potential for termination of parental rights, that she is in fact giving up a constitutional right to parent her child. I guess I'd be interested in hearing your position as to whether that is indeed accurate.
I think the inquiry into whether or not the parents are giving up the rights is secondary to whether or not they know that the potential is there for it. I think in a lot of TPR cases, the parents
your first party, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
sure,
that first response sort of exposes the whole. It's the difference, you see, may very well be the very, very important difference between the actual waiver of a constitutional right versus a potential loss of a constitutional right.
It was addressed in the unpublished case that I cited to James M., where they said that there wasn't a necessity to inform the parent of the potential loss of the constitutional right.
And so it seems to me that so far we've all been kind of assuming for the purposes of argument that it is accurate to say that at the grounds phase, at the first phase, and by the waiver of the grounds phase, an admission to the existence of grounds, that someone in Brenda B's position is actually giving up a constitutional right.
I don't think so. I think more of my argument is built for if this court should decide that that's the case, what happened in this case was sufficient.
How could it be accurate to say that by admitting to the grounds, to the existence of grounds, that the actual fact of the waiver of the constitutional right is occurring? Any more so than in a criminal pleading, which in the briefs this matter has been analogized to under the Bangor standards of knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, that you don't, at a plea hearing, to make to ensure that the defendant is giving a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent a plea, you would inform that person that they have a potential consequence of up to the maximum potential penalty. So the maximum could be anything up to however many years, life in prison, without the possibility of parole. Or say it's 20 years. You wouldn't tell the defendant, do you understand that by your admission to this offense, you are going to be sentenced to 20 years?
Correct.
You are going to say, sir, do you understand that you could be sentenced up to 20 years?
I agree. And I guess I don't really have a way to respond to that, but for that, James M. indicates that that's not something that needs to be conveyed to the parent. However, if this court makes the decision that it should be, I think what happened in this case is sufficient to let the parent know that that information was out there.
And this is a good time to segue and focus in on the maximum potential outcome, which is the second part, which you very neatly sure. summarized at the beginning of your argument.
Before we get to that, if I might, in this particular case, the judge withheld the finding of unfitness, didn't he?
He withheld that finding until we came back for the dispositional hearing to give right. the mother an opportunity to enter a voluntary plea to the TPR petition.
Right. And then before the dispositional stage was started, did he then make a finding?
Yes, he did. That was the first thing that happened at that hearing.
So you don't think it's relevant that it was withheld, that the finding was withheld? Until
no, I asked the circuit court to make the finding right away at the plea hearing. I would prefer it to be that way. But the court made the decision that they were going to wait until the dispositional hearing to make the finding.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As to the potential dispositions, the department relies on Therese S., which was a 2008 Court of Appeals case decided by a three-judge panel. That case states, at the very least, a circuit court must inform the parent that at the dispositional hearing, the court will either dismiss the petition or terminate parental rights. Brenda B. is alleging that that's insufficient to inform the parent of the two primary dispositions, and that the parent really needs to be informed of all the sub-dispositions that occur after the court terminates the parental rights under 48.427 sub 3. Therese S. declined to adopt that expansive approach offered by the parent, which required the circuit court to inform parents in detail of all potential outcomes. My position on this is that if you look at the dispositions that come after 48.427 sub 3, those all are conditioned on the court first terminating the parental rights of the parent. I would define those dispositions as sub-dispositions, and their effect goes to the child post-termination of parental rights and not to the parent themselves. In the criminal plea context, as Justice Gableman and I had discussed before, Bangert requires the circuit court to notify defendants of the direct consequences of their plea. In the termination of parental rights arena, the two direct consequences are that the circuit court will either dismiss the petition or that the circuit court will either terminate the parental rights.
So let's take a look at the statute, because that's what this portion of the argument really addresses. And that statute, of course, is 48.422 sub 7A. And it says, before accepting an admission of the alleged facts in a petition, the court shall address the parties present and determine that the admission is made voluntarily with the understanding of the nature of the acts alleged in the petition. Now I get to the important language, and the potential dispositions. How many potential dispositions are there in a TPR proceeding?
My position on that is that there are two potential dispositions. First, that the court may dismiss the petition, and second, the court may enter an order terminating the parental rights of the parent. After that happens, I think there are some collateral consequences which are contained within 48.427 3M 2 sub 4.
That seems to me a novel reading. It's not the reading of Theresa S. As I understood Theresa S. kind of wrote a word or two into the statute saying the primary dispositions. And now you're saying the kind of sub-dispositions. I have always thought that the dispositions under the statute are dismissal, termination, guardianship, sustaining care. Are there additional dispositions other than that, those four?
Well, the statute goes into, in what I refer to as a sub-disposition section, different options for the guardianship pending adoption.
Sure. But those are the four dispositions in a TPR. Dismiss it, grant it, do a sustaining care, do a guardianship. Are they or are they not the four dispositions? You may disagree with me, I'm just asking.
Yeah, I disagree with it in that the guardianship and the sustaining care are options that the court has once you dismiss that parent's parental rights in terms of where the child's going to end up.
What do you mean dismiss the...
If you terminate the parental rights, I'm sorry,
okay,
under sub 3,
right.
Then so there's some saying, other options that affect the child.
You're saying that the guardianship and what was the other one?
Sustaining care.
Sustaining care don't come into play unless there is a TPR.
Correct.
Because if it's dismissed, it won't come into play, right?
No. The case will probably continue under the CHIPS order and the parent will continue working on that condition.
So to get to guardianship and sustaining care, you first enter an order of TPR.
Correct.
Then you have to decide what you can do with the child because now the child is under the state's custody and care and the state becomes the parent because the state has taken away all parental rights, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And in this case, what was informed to Brenda B. was that upon the finding of unfitness, the matter would proceed to the dispositional hearing where the best interest of the child would be the standard. And at that point, the court would either terminate the parental rights or dismiss the petition. And then we also identified that there was a proposed adoptive resource.
Mr. Collins, my understanding is that Mr. Kaczynski wants to have an evidentiary hearing in regard to all of this. Judge Hinkfuss denied an evidentiary hearing. Your position, as I understand it, is there should not be an evidentiary hearing. Would you explain why that's your position?
Yes, Justice. My position on it is if you view the plea colloquy transcript in this case, the deficiencies that are alleged by the parent, that the dispositions weren't communicated to the parent, and that the constitutional right to parent wasn't informed to the parent, that really what the court did was sufficient, and if the transcript is quote-unquote unassailable, the case law says that you don't pass that first hurdle of Bangert and there's no evidentiary hearing necessary.
So you're saying there's no prima facie case presented by Mr. Kaczynski?
Correct, and that was the circuit court's position as well.
Your argument that there are only two dispositions and other potential consequences come only after the one of the two dispositions has a ring of merit, and you're grounding that on what?
My reading of the 3S case, Your Honor, and also the reasoning of the Court of Appeals in this case. The Court of Appeals in this case made the holding that if you look at the two primary dispositions, those are the two dispositions out there that affect the parents. Beyond that, what they refer to as a sub-disposition, those are options that affect the child post-termination. And in looking at whether the parent's making a voluntary and informed decision regarding the results of their no contest plea, I think that it's sufficient if the court hones in on those two primary dispositions that that's what's really going to be the end result for that parent.
If a parent is voluntarily terminating parental rights, does the law require that they be advised of the potential for sustaining care and for guardianship?
I do not believe that it does require that. There was a case that addressed the voluntary admission to TPR, and what's different at that type of proceeding is that parent needs to be informed of the alternatives to termination of parental rights so they know what their options are should they decide to discontinue their voluntary plea and proceed with the matter from there.
In the case of Teresa S., it seems to me your argument is different than that case. By the very fact that they say, okay, look, you only need to be told of the two primary dispositions that suggest that there are other dispositions you don't need to be told of. Your argument seems to be they are not dispositions at all. That is, sustaining care and guardianship are not dispositions, and yet Teresa S., and indeed this Court of Appeals, embraces Teresa S. with regard to, we conclude that at the very least, a circuit court must confirm a parent's understanding of the true primary dispositions under 48.4.27.2 and 3.
My reasoning for taking a slight deviation from Teresa S. is the following situation. Let's say we have a parent whose parental rights are terminated and the court makes the finding that it's in the best interest of the child that that parent's rights be terminated and orders that the care and custody and guardianship of that child go to the State Department of Children and Families pending adoption. Should that adoption fail, in so much as the State Department of Children and Families is unable to find an adoptive home for the child, that matter may have to go back into court, and at that time the court could amend the order to order guardianship as an alternative to that adoption. And that kind of situation, to me, lends me to believe that the guardianship and the sustaining care are really sub-dispositions because at that hearing, the parental rights would be terminated and that parent would really have no say in what happened there.
Counsel, you seem to me, quite frankly, to be a very good and experienced person in this area of law, and I say that very positively, as does your opposing counsel, both of you. And what a delight to have these arguments today. And so you speak to me of practicality, of how things should work, and your concern about how things should work. I understand that. But I'm also really focusing on what does the statute require? It seems to me both this Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals in Teresa S., by negative implication at the very least, have indicated that there are other dispositions other than the two primary dispositions. When they use the language, we conclude that at the very least a circuit court must confirm a parent's understanding of the two primary dispositions. If there are other dispositions, doesn't the clear language of the statute, which says that the judge must advise of the dispositions, isn't that being violated? I mean, it doesn't say the primary dispositions or the major ones, but not the sub ones. There are more than the two primary, apparently. Two Court of Appeals have said. Do you disagree with those two Court of Appeals? That
no,
there
I do
are
not.
More than the two primary? Then there are other dispositions. Why aren't those under the clear language of the statute to be advised of, that is, guardianship and sustaining care?
Well, it would be nice if the statute would read the potential dispositions pursuant to 48.427, either sub 2 to sub 3 or sub 2 to sub 4. However, it just refers to the potential dispositions. And in looking at the case law that's out there addressing this issue, I really think that if you look at it, in order for the parent's decision to enter the no contest plea to be knowing and voluntary, they need to know of those two primary dispositions that affect them.
So you're writing into the statute the word primary. The Court of Appeals apparently did. And are you too?
I'm interpreting it as that those two dispositions within that statute are the primary ones as they affect the parents.
The problem is that the way the statute is written, two says may dismiss. Three says may terminate. 3M says if the rights are, then guardianship. 3P says if the rights are, then guardianship. And then 4 says termination, then whatever it does. They're all written at the same level. If you look at the statute, they are not written, here's two ways of doing it, one, two, and then here, as a result of one way of doing it, here's the court's alternatives. They're all seemingly written as equals.
Correct,
right?
But the language of the 3M through the 4 indicate if the court first terminates the parental rights.
That's the exact language, that's right. But the way this is written in terms of dispositions, They are all equally set forth as dispositions in subsections. What look like equal subsections. Right?
Correct. I can't dispute that.
So your reading deviates from the plain language and plain text.
Yes, based on the path that Teresa has led me.
As I understand your argument, counsel, those what you've referred to as subdispositions are dependent upon a binary determination. Either the parental rights are going to be terminated or they are not going to be.
Correct.
And if they are not going to be, those subdispositions cannot come into effect. True?
That's true.
And that, it seems to me, from my reading of your briefs and listening to you here today, that seems to be the basis of your argument, not reading words into the statute. You are, in response to Chief Justice Abramson, you just kind of indicated that you were deviating from the plain language of the statute, but that was not my interpretation of your argument from the briefs. It runs to the fact that those other dispositions are dependent upon the two, what you've referred to as primary determinations, but others may think of as an either-or situation. Either the parental rights are going to be terminated or they are not. And if they're not going to be, then those other potential dispositions will never come into effect.
That is correct.
All right.
Can I ask, do you have the statute in front of you?
Yes, I do.
48422 sub 8. What is that report that's referred to?
Which statute?
48422.
My reference to that is that if the petition is not contested, the court shall hear testimony in support of the allegations in the petition, including testimony as required in sub 7.
That's
the jump down then to everything that needs to be informed to the parent when they're entering an admission to the petition.
In the statute that I have in front of me, it might not be exactly the same. Subsection 8, if the petition for termination of parental rights is filed by an agency enumerated in section 480691 or 2, the court shall order the agency to submit a report to the court as provided in 48425. What report is that?
That is the social worker's report that gets submitted to the court prior to the disposition hearing, and that's a report that goes over the standards and factors that are laid out in 48.426 regarding the adaptability of the child, the length of time the child's been in out-of-home care, and whether or not the child's entering into a more permanent and stable relationship.
Is that report submitted before or after the plea?
In Brown County, we usually have that report submitted at the point in time where we have the hearing on the petition. And the reason that I have the workers do that is should the parent opt to not appear at that court hearing and we have them served, then they're phoned in default, and we try to get the whole proceeding done on that date. I can't speak to how other counties do it, but we usually have that report filed on the first day we go into court.
Would that report go into any of the dispositions collateral dispositions we've been talking about?
Most of the time, the report will indicate what the department is asking for, and in 100% of the termination of parental rights cases that I've had in the 2 years I've been with Brown County, that has been a recommendation that the court give the care, custody, and guardianship to the department, State Department of Children and Families pending adoption.
Is that report given to the parent?
Yes, it is.
Is the parent entitled to ask questions about dispositions?
The parents could, at the dispositional hearing, make in their closing argument a recommendation as to what they want to happen.
At the plea. Now, when the court advises the parent of potential dispositions, may the parent ask a follow-up question about that?
I suppose they could. In all honesty, I've never had that happen.
Is it typical for the court at the near the conclusion but prior to the finding at the admissions phase to ask a person in Brenda B's position if they have any questions in regard to anything? And was that done here?
It was. And during the whole plea colloquy, the circuit court asked Brenda B on multiple occasions to stop the proceeding if she ever had any questions. Feel free to raise her hand and interrupt the court. And
Did she?
She didn't, but she was able to correct the court on some points that she made, which led me to believe that she understood what was going on. When the court asked her if she was willing to make an admission to the petition, Brenda B. stopped the proceedings and informed the court that she wanted to make a no-contest plea because she still wanted to contest the dispositional hearing. So I see my red lights up. I would ask that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court's order and decision regarding the motion to withdraw the no contest plea. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kaczynski.
I think we have two important points to make on behalf of Brenda B., and that is, first of all, the loss of the constitutional right to parent. Absent any kind of misconduct or other circumstances, a parent has a right under the Constitution, or a person has a right under the Constitution to parent, just like they have the opportunity and the right for free speech, for right to assemble, so on and so forth. If it's a constitutional right that we're going to infringe upon in any type of situation, it takes compelling circumstances and not just a consensus or a desire for to do things differently before we take away that constitutional right. When you go to the grounds phase of a termination of parental rights proceeding and you admit that there's grounds for termination of parental rights, at that point, that preference, that strict scrutiny that exists, that every parent has before that right can be taken away, is gone. At that point, any right that parent has on the second phase of a termination of parental rights proceeding is at the sufferance of the presiding judge and of the state under the best interest of the child standard. So I think there is a difference in terms of losing your constitutional right to parent as opposed to the final decision where your parental rights are no longer given that strict scrutiny or deference and you lose it at the second phase of a dispositional hearing. That goes to the second issue of dispositions and the significance of that. I think the questions that have been asked of Mr. Collins as to the statute are absolutely right on point. The statute says dispositions that you're asked about that the court needs to advise a parent about, which includes not only that the court can dismiss the petition, but also sustaining care and guardianship. There are situations I've seen in appeals of TPR cases in other counties where the parents' concern at disposition is not so much whether or not they're going to lose their parental rights, but that instead of the child going to the party that's preferred by the county, such as an adoptive parent, they want to have a child placed in guardianship of a relative or something like that. And a lot of times that's not practical. A lot of times it's not in the best interest of the child. But that certainly is a potential disposition that a parent could be interested in asking a court to do in the second phase of a termination of parental rights proceeding. That is, not to go along with the adoption proceeding, but give the child and the guardianship to a relative that's stable and can take care of the child. And in that respect, if that's done, even if the parental rights are gone, that parent may feel that they will have some opportunity at some point in the future to have contact with the child continuously, just through permission of their relatives.
Kaczynski,
I think it's significant.
If the court gave the option of perhaps placing the child with a relative under the statute, but then didn't do that, wouldn't that almost be inducing a plea by creating a false expectation?
I'm not sure it's a false expectation, just as it's not a predetermined end to a termination of parental rights case that the rights will be terminated, although, quite frankly, it does happen probably well over 90% of the time. But I think it's often a reason why parents will continue to want to participate in a termination of parental rights proceeding, even if they know that there are sound grounds that can be proven that the rights should be terminated. They want to have voice in the second phase, that it goes to a relative of theirs rather than it goes to the proposed adoptive parent or to an adoption agency.
In this case, I think the Chief Justice asked a question of exactly when the court accepted the plea of no contest, and that wasn't until the dispositional hearing? Did the report that I alluded to under 448.422(8), did that go to the parent before or after the actual plea in this case? It was accepted.
Right. I'm not sure if Brenda saw the report before or after the plea. I think what Judge Hinkvist was doing in withholding the finding of unfitness was in hope of a voluntary TPR that Brenda's right to parent future children would not be infringed, because then there wouldn't be grounds for the termination of parental rights when you've been terminated on a prior child involuntarily.
Thank you, Mr. Kaczynski, and thank you, Mr. Collins, for another argument on the very important issue of a termination of parental rights. That concludes 10 AP 321, Brown County Department of Human Services versus Brenda B. Is that counsel? Pardon me? The discussion will be at noon, and when I say noon, approximately there. It's be after the second argument, which should be just about at noon. It will be right here in the conference room. And if you turn around, I think that you will see Menominee Falls High School students. Would they please stand up?
In the courtroom.
Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And then we'll talk to the students for a few moments before our fire alarm goes off at 11 a.m.